Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to see everybody here this fine Sabbath day here on a bright sunny day in Arkansas. And I say that in absolute positive good humor because I heard up north in Michigan, where I'm from, they've got the Lake Effect snow machine going. And some of the roads that I traveled on typically, there was a 40 to 50 car pileup yesterday from Lake Effect snows. So I don't miss that at all. And glad to be here. Welcome to all of our visitors here today who are not really visitors. Glad to have everybody here with us. And today is our Bible study day, so my sermon will be a little bit on the shorter side, as you know, shorten it down a little bit. Then we'll take a 10-minute break or so, and then we'll come back for the Bible study, which today we are going through Genesis chapter 38 through 40. Some familiar territory that we'll be going through, but hopefully we'll bring out some information that will be new and helpful and enlighten you on those particular scriptures. While I'm thinking of it, because I mentioned this to the Jonesboro congregation last week, but I am speculating that I will be done with Genesis sometime in April, which, you know, we've been going through that slowly but surely here in the last year and a half. And I've been getting a lot of feedback about the Bible studies. And one of the reasons that I wanted to go to Genesis, because it's so important, because it's beginnings, you know, the beginning, the recreation of the earth, marriage was established in Genesis. Of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the promises. So much of the beginnings of everything takes place in Genesis, so that's why I wanted to go there. But somebody asked me, well, I guess it was last month or so, Mr. Nance, what are you going to do after this? And I said, well, there was one member in the Little Rock congregation who's not here today. I think he's sick. Heard he was sick. And he said, well, just keep on going. Go Exodus, Leviticus, you know, Deuteronomy. And so I posed that to the brethren up north, and I got one person that said, yes, keep going in that particular manner. So anyways, I'm open for feedback. I think that, I want to do what will be helpful to you. So if you want me to continue to go through the Pentateuch, we can do that, or we can shift gears and go in another direction. But just let me know what your thoughts are. If I don't get a whole lot of feedback, then I most likely will continue on through, and we'll go into the book of Exodus. Okay, continuing on with the announcements here, let's take a look at the schedule. Let's see. The next thing that you need to be aware of is, let's see, I got an announcement for this. Okay, yes, the fun show. 2 weeks from today on January the 2nd. Please sign the list today if you haven't done so. You must get your accompanying into Lonnie or Bruce by next Sabbath. You'll have to pardon me. I've got some new glasses, and I'm still trying to get used to them. And I think the bifocal part is not right on this, and I'm having trouble reading, so. Okay, we're planning on having a taco bar after services on January the 2nd. Please sign the list for what you are bringing. So fun show 2 weeks from today. Of course, that'll be after sundown. And sign the list if you've got something that you would like to present to the congregation. And I think the first Sabbath in February, although I don't have an announcement on that, but I think that we might be having a bingo game night kind of thing, so kind of keep that in mind possibly as well. Okay, let's see. I guess the other thing that I need to bring to your attention is the next Bible study, which will be the third Sabbath of the month, January the 16th. January the 16th, third Bible study of the month. And I guess I might as well let you know, too, that 2 days after that, Lydia and I are going to be going to Argentina for a couple of weeks. We are taking advantage of some frequent flyer miles that we have accumulated over the years, going to Spanish-speaking sites, etc. And I haven't been back there in 5 years since I performed my stepson's wedding. So we're going to take a little vacation for a couple weeks and go to Argentina. It's summertime. It will be summertime down there, so that's a little added bonus. So just wanted to let you know that as well. Okay. I think that's as far as the calendar is concerned, all I needed to bring to your attention. Some announcements from the home office here. First of all, there's going to be personal appearance campaigns coming to 10 more cities. As you know, in November, we had personal appearance campaigns by the Beyond Today television presenters in Texas, in three cities in Texas. And now they're going to be moving on to 10 more cities throughout 2016. And the first one will be in Nashville, Tennessee, on Sunday, February the 21st. And then basically they go up north for a while, Indianapolis, Indiana in March, Columbus, Ohio in April, Chicago in June, Cleveland, Ohio in August, Dayton, Ohio in August, and then come back south to North Carolina in September. So there's 10 dates where they're going to be doing personal appearance campaigns. So please pray for the success of the campaigns, that, of course, good new subscribers and Beyond Today television program watchers are going to be invited to come to those. So pray for the success of that and that the gospel message can continue to go forward. Then some activities. The 2016 Atlanta ski trip, for those of you that are young at heart and like to ski, that will be in Gatlinburg, Tennessee on Sunday, February the 7th. Let's see, if you can actually go to a website, the atlantaucg.org ski activity site, and you can find out more information from there. Okay, and I can give you some more information if you'd like that as well. Then another activity, let's see, the Cincinnati Family Dance Weekend. That will be taking place on the President's Day weekend, February 12th through 14th. So if you're interested in that particular activity, there's also going to be a snow tubing ski snowboard activity on Sunday, February 14th, which is nearby Cincinnati. So I don't know with this El Nino going on. I hope they have some snow up there, but they're planning on it anyways. I think there's actually a lot of activities for the President's Day weekend. This activity in Cincinnati, we usually have in Texas, the Big Sandy congregation hosts a family weekend over the President's Day weekend. And also there's a ladies' weekend in the Branson area, which I don't have any information on that. So there's a lot to do if you would like to do something and you have some free time the President's Day weekend. Okay, that's all of the announcements. I do want to bring a prayer request update to you, and I'm glad to see Earl McCorder back with us here today. He must obviously be getting around a lot better. I don't see him jumping up and down yet, but he's moving, and that's a good sign. So glad to have you back and recovering from your knee surgery. Frank Sims from the Memphis congregation, as I've been mentioning to you, has been going through cancer treatment for prostate cancer. He was supposed to have radiation treatment this last Tuesday, but they postponed it to Monday. So my understanding is that he's going to be getting radiation and chemotherapy this coming Monday. So please continue to pray for Frank Sims that the therapy will go well and that God will intervene according to his will. Okay, that's all the announcements that I have for you today, so we can get into the sermon. In our last sermon that I gave to you 2 weeks ago today, we observed how paganism was blended into Christianity by the means of the Roman emperors and false prophets at the time of Christ, during the first century A.D. And these false prophets deliberately mixed paganism into Christian teaching while claiming inspiration from God in doing so. The early church in the first century was plagued by many professed Christian, quote, Christian teachers, claiming that they were inspired by God, and advocating the right to participate in pagan practices, blending pagan practices into Christianity. That's what was happening in the first century AD. Those pagan practices that were blended into Christianity were many of the same pagan practices that God condemned in the Old Testament scriptures back in those ancient times. Practices that he warned through his prophets to stay away from. Turn with me to begin with, please, to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4, in verse number 19. This is a section of scripture where Moses was giving instructions to the children of Israel that were going to be going into the promised land, giving them the instructions from God, and also warnings from God. Deuteronomy chapter 4, and notice in verse number 19, here's the warning. Take heed, lest when you lift your eyes to heaven, when you see the sun, the moon, and the stars, and all the host of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord your God has given to all peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage. So God was warning the children of Israel, those that were going to be occupying the promised land, don't worship, don't look up into the heaven and begin to worship the sun, the moon, and the stars the way that all the other nations and the pagans did all around. And the reason God was giving this warning is because by that time, all these other nations were deep, very deep into the pagan worship, and especially the sun, the moon, and the stars. In Near Eastern thought and culture, the sun and the moon were the most important deities. And also the stars were thought to control one's destiny. Remember, Adam and Eve were driven from the Garden of Eden. And as man was driven away from the Garden of Eden and lost touch with God, man began to wonder, you know, how did we come to be on this earth? They lost the knowledge of God. And as Haley's Bible commentary puts out, they were groping for a solution to the mysteries of existence. And they came to worship the powers of nature, which seemed to be the sources of life. So God gave a warning to the children of Israel. Notice verse 23. Take heed to yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of anything which the Lord your God has forbidden you to do. A warning to Israel not to make idols like the rest of the pagan cultures were doing, in the likeness of anything, the form and image of anything as well. In the last sermon that I gave to you a couple weeks ago now, we examined the blending process that took place between paganism and Christianity in New Testament times. But that blending process wasn't the first time it took, in New Testament times, it wasn't the first time that it took place. It goes all the way back to ancient times as well. And God gave the ancient Israelites specific instructions not to borrow or copy the pagan practices of the nations around them. But the truth is, millions of, quote, professing Christians today are observing the same days that have borrowed from pagan practices and are found nowhere in the pages of the Bible. The title of the sermon today is The Rise of False Religion, Part 2, The Blending of Pagan Practices. I'll repeat that. The Rise of False Religion, Part 2, The Blending of Pagan Practices. Today, we will examine the roots of pagan blending practices. And we'll examine those roots from the earliest biblical times and examining those practices in a short history of it during the Old Testament times. Let's go to Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4. We actually covered this in the Bible study series, but let's focus in on this again and maybe a little bit deeper this time. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 26, and this is the section of Scripture. Chapter 4 we call the way of Cain, because after Adam and Eve had been driven from the Garden of Eden, we come into chapter 4, which talks about Cain and Abel. And they both brought offerings to God, and Abel's offering was accepted by God, but Cain's wasn't. And he actually committed the first murder and killed his brother. And then chapter 4 is a history of the way of Cain, how man began to slide further and further away from God. Let's pick it up in verse 25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. So again, Cain and his descendants were slipping farther and farther away from God, and God had another son born to Adam and Eve, his name being Seth, who would continue on the line away from the line of Cain. Verse number 26. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. And this is what I want to focus in, the last part of verse 26. It says, then men began to call on the name of the Lord. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. Now this phrase, the last part of verse 26, is very difficult from the Hebrew. And commentators go all over the place with this particular phrase. Some of them will say, isn't this great? Men began to call on the name of the Lord. Isn't that great that this was happening? And yet, when you put it into the context of the Scriptures, it doesn't fit at all. First of all, again, in chapter 4, we have the way of Cain, as man slipped away from God and got worse and worse. In verse 23, it talks about Lamech, who said that he could kill a man for wounding him. He was wounded, and he could take revenge and kill a man. Again, the way of Cain. After this, in chapter 5, is simply a chapter of genealogy, the genealogy of Adam, which was typical in Genesis, where certain chapters would focus on the descendants and list the names of the descendants. But when you pick up the story again, it's actually in chapter 6. It goes from chapter 4 to chapter 6. And what do we find in the context of chapter 6? The wickedness of man, that was so wicked that God finally had to send the floodwaters upon the earth to destroy the wickedness of man, except for, of course, Noah and his family. So the context here around this verse is man going downhill and getting worse. So how could it be that in the midst of all of this, men began to call on the name of the Lord? Again, it really doesn't fit. The Companion Bible, I think, hits it on the head. It says this: not that they began to worship, for Abel worshipped. And Abel did worship. Abel presented an offering to God, and God accepted it. It was a good offering. Abel worshipped God. So this wasn't the beginning of worshiping God at all. It continues on to say, but here, man began to call upon their gods by the name of Jehovah. Let me repeat that. Here they began to call upon their gods by the name of Jehovah. In other words, calling upon the sun, the moon, and the stars, or whatever gods they were worshiping, using God's name, blending it together in the worship of God. Jameson Fawcett and Brown points out in its commentary as well that some of the older commentators say that they began to profanely call upon the name of the Lord. In the Companion Bible's appendix, it says this: the majority of ancient Jewish commentators supply the ellipsis, that's the missing words, by the words their gods, suggesting that they call the stars and idols their gods and worship them. Call the stars and the idols their gods and worship them in the name of Jehovah. Again, this blending of paganism while using God's name. Again, it goes back to ancient times. Then you know the story as we fast forward after the flood and Noah's sons began to multiply upon the earth. We come to the story of the Tower of Babel. We won't turn there. I'll just summarize it for you. The Tower of Babel, Babylon, in Genesis chapter 11, where they began to build this tower, most likely trying to get up as high as they could up into the heavens, so as some sort of observatory to, again, worship the sun, the moon, and the stars. And what they were doing was wickedness in God's sight, and he judged the builders of the Tower of Babel. And what did he do? He scattered them throughout the earth, confused the languages, and they dispersed. Through history, we find that the leaders, after they had built some huge cities, a civilization back in those days, moved on to Egypt, where they continued on with their pagan religion. And there, God judged them again. You know, through the story of in the book of Exodus, the 10 plagues, as God judged Egypt and eventually allowed the children of Israel to come out of their slavery. Let's go to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. And of course, this brings us to the 10th plague, the killing of the firstborn of Egypt. Exodus chapter 12 and verse number 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And notice the last part of verse number 12. And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. So this 10th and final plague was against all of the gods. And the Egyptians had a whole host of gods, virtually hundreds of gods that they worshipped, all kinds of nature worshipped, frogs, bulls, sun, moon, stars, you name it, even trees. And God was judging the Egyptians through this 10th and final plague. And you know the story, the children of Israel were finally released from their slavery. Pharaoh let them go, and the Israelites began to go out to eventually make their way through the Red Sea. Pharaoh and his army would be drowned in the Red Sea, and the children of Israel came into the desert. Now let's pick up the story. Again, this is a well-known story, but let's go to Exodus chapter 32. And let's continue to see how this blending process of paganism into worshiping God was now beginning to affect the children of Israel. Exodus chapter 34, this is the account where Moses had been delayed from coming down from Mount Sinai when he was actually talking with God, and God was giving him instructions. And as he was delayed, the children of Israel took note of that, and they began a rebellion. Exodus chapter 32. We'll get to chapter 34 in a moment. Exodus chapter 32 and verse number 1. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us." You know, when I read that section right there, I just think how pitiful. How pitiful of the children of Israel. They had been in slavery in Egypt under the taskmaster's whips, you know, doing hard labor, bricks and mortar and all that they were doing. They're finally freed from their slavery by Almighty God, and they want to say, "Let's get up and make other gods," like the Egyptians. "As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off their golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. The calf was one of the principal gods in Egypt. They worshipped the calf. We'll talk about that in the Bible study later on. Then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Again, how pitiful. And a direct lie, because it wasn't the golden calf that brought them out of Egypt. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." To the Lord. Blending process again, where they take this golden calf that represented God and they began to worship it. And then take it to another level and proclaim a false feast day to worship this God. And you know, that process has continued on throughout history, over and over again, repeating itself. The blending of pagan practices, saying you're worshiping God, and actually making other days to worship Him. We're in the middle of that season right now. The calf represented God. Stephen in Acts chapter 7, we won't turn there, but he said, "In their hearts," referring to the children of Israel, "they turned back from Egypt." They fell back into Egypt and were affected by it. So let's go now to one of the first warnings that God gave to them. Let's go to Exodus 34, just a couple, few pages forward. And let's take a look at the warnings that God gave to Israel when they're in the desert. They had just worshipped the golden calf because Moses had delayed his coming. Let's see what God says. Exodus chapter 34, verse number 11. "Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I am driving out from before you the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite." God says, "I'm going to take care of those occupants, those Canaanites that are in the promised land. I'm going to drive them out." Then notice the warning in verse number 12. "Take heed," or beware, watch out. "Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be a snare in your midst." This talking about making a covenant or a treaty implies accepting their gods, accepting them and taking them into your own, making a treaty with them. Verse 13, "But you shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images." So destroy their altars, the sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images. Now, if you have a marginal reference, like my particular Bible does, it talks about what these wooden images are. Wooden images in verse number 13, if you're reading in the Old King James, it actually says groves. Groves. And that comes from a Hebrew word, Asherah. Asherah. And this is the first time in scriptures that this is noted, the first time of 40 times in the Old Testament, the groves or the wooden images. The Companion Bible says, "The groves denote a phallic image worshipped by libidinous rites and lascivious practices." There was all kinds of business that went on that was terrible in God's sight. The images in verse 13 were the sacred pillars. The Bible Knowledge Commentary says, "The Canaanites erected poles in honor of the goddess Asherah, consort of Baal. And they were Canaanite fertility symbols." This is what God said to destroy and completely take down. Here's a description of the Asherah from the New Bible Dictionary. Asherah was a Canaanite mother goddess associated in the Old Testament with Baal. While the Old Testament sometimes refers to Asherah as a goddess, the name is also used of an image made for that goddess. So the Asherah, these wooden images, could either be the goddess or the image representing the goddess, an idol, in other words. The Companion Bible adds this: "Asherah was so called because it was something set upright or erect in the ground and worshipped." The word is always rendered grove or groves. From the passages, we learn that it was either a living tree with the top cut off, or it was artificially fashioned and set erect in the ground. Trees that were worshipped in association with this pagan worship. It's often coupled with stone pillars, connected with Baal worship, and associated with the goddess Ashtoreth. So this was the warning that God gave to the children of Israel while they're in the desert. He also gave them another warning as they began to occupy the promised land. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 12. He gave them many warnings, but let's take a look at another one of these. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 1 through 4. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse number 1. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord, your God of your fathers, is giving to you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. Verse number 2. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess served their gods. Notice where they served them. On the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. This was the specific locations that they served and worshiped their gods. And most of the time they tried to get up as high as they could, mountains, the hills, and that way they were closer to the worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars. Again, Allah, the Tower of Babel. But there was also this tree worship that was associated as well, as it says, under every green tree. Verse number 3, and you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images. Or again, the marginal reference, the Asherim. And you shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. Verse 4, you shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. In other words, God spells it out here in verse number 4. Don't blend these pagan practices that they're doing and say you're worshiping me. Don't do it at all. Verse number 5, then he goes on to tell them about where they should be worshiping, the place which he shall choose in his specific feast days, etc. Then we come down to further warning in verse number 29. Verse 29, here's that two-word phrase again, take heed, be watchful, be on alert. Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them. That should stand out in the history of mankind, because virtually all of mankind has been ensnared in these practices throughout history. And the Israelites would be as well. And they are, as we're reading this. They were becoming that way. Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods? I will do also likewise. You know, I'll begin to incorporate some of their practices in my worship as well. God says, don't do that. Verse 31, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination to the Lord, which he hates, they have done to their gods. And he lists one of the abominations in the last part of verse 31. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. You know, if you check into some of the history, some of the archaeological discoveries in the land of Canaan and even other areas, sometimes they've actually found jars full of baby parts, the remains of little children that were sacrificed to their gods back in those days. As God says, abominations, horrible things. And that's what they did. Verse 32, whatever I command you, you shall be careful to observe, and you shall not add to it or take away from it. And you know, mankind has been doing that throughout history, adding things to the worship of God and saying, it's okay to do. Let's go now, let's continue on, let's fast forward in the history of Israel again, because it wasn't just the pagans that were wrapped up in this. Israel got real involved in it as well. 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12. Another history that you're very familiar with. when the tribe of Israel was split into two different sections. The northern tribe of Israel, 10 tribes of Israel, would become known as Israel, and Judah and Benjamin would be known as the tribe of Judah. Remember the history that Solomon was ruling over Israel, which was probably the most powerful nation on earth at that particular time, and certainly wealthy. But Solomon, because he had married so many women and had so many concubines, they began to turn him away from God. And he began to sin and worship other gods. And God told him that he's going to lose the kingdom. And by a particular prophet, said that he would lose that kingdom, and that Jeroboam, who was a mighty prince in Ephraim, would become the king of the northern tribes of Israel. Actually, let's pick it up in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse number 40. Solomon got wind that Jeroboam was going to somehow, he got wind somehow that he was going to become the ruler of the northern tribes, and he sets out to kill him. And then we see in verse number 40, Solomon therefore sought to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam arose, and where did he go? He fled to Egypt, and to Shinar, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. And what do you think Jeroboam learned big time while he was in Egypt? The Egyptian religion. He got well into it, learned all about it, and he was going to infect Israel when he comes back. Again, I don't have time to go through all of this particular story, but eventually the two tribes did split. The tribe of Judah with Solomon's son Rehoboam as their king, and the 10 northern tribes with Jeroboam as their king. Now Jeroboam, he becomes the king of the northern tribes, the 10 tribes of Israel. And think about this. As I said, under Solomon, Israel was probably the most powerful nation on earth, certainly the most rich, the richest nation in that time in history. Jeroboam becomes king over this powerful realm. And he doesn't want to lose what he's got. It's a good thing. And he starts to worry. Now, wait a minute. And I'm putting this in my own words. What if the children of Israel go to keep the feast like they normally would? They're going to go to Jerusalem to worship. And then they're going to tie in with Rehoboam and I'll lose everything I've got. So he begins to invent something. Let's pick it up in 1 Kings 12, verse 25. 1 Kings 12, verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. And he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. Verse 27. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So Jeroboam doesn't want to lose what he's got, and he doesn't want to lose the children of Israel if they go to keep one of the feasts. So he comes up with a deliberate plan to try to keep what he has. Let's continue on. Verse 28. Therefore the king asked advice, made 2 calves of gold. Now where do you think he got this idea about the calves? In Egypt, where he was at. And we're going to see history repeating itself with the children of Israel. Made 2 calves of gold and said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. Exactly the same lie that Aaron and his cohorts had done in the time of Moses and said. And again, here we have the calf representing God. The blending of paganism with worshiping God, being repeated again in the history of Israel. But a deliberate blending on the part of King Jeroboam. Verse 29, he set up one of the calves in Bethel, which was to the north, in the northern part of Israel. And he put the other in Dan in the southern part to cover both ends of the territory so they had the calves to worship. Verse 30, now this thing became a sin for the people And they went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And notice verse 31. He made shrines, altars to these gods, on the high places, exactly the way the pagans did. And made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. What that's telling us in verse 31 is he became the high priest of this religion. Remember 2 weeks ago when we were talking about the fact that the Roman emperors took the title of Pontifex Maximus during their time, the high priest in their pagan religion, which eventually the Pope took that particular title later on in history. So the Roman emperors weren't the first to do this, to take this position of high priest. Here we see it in the history of Israel with Jeroboam. And he makes priests of the lowest of people, anybody that would go along with him, in other words. And he takes it even a step further, like we saw in Exodus chapter 32. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he sets up an alternative feast day, just like the ancient Israelites had done previously. A deliberate blending. And Jeroboam combined the worship of God with the worship of Baal, the nature and sexual rites of the pagans. Again, history repeats itself with the children of Israel. The calf represents God, and then they substitute a pagan festival, saying that they were worshiping God. But it got worse. It actually got worse in the history of the children of Israel. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 16. We're going to see two kings that were worse than Jeroboam. If you go to some commentaries, and Haley's is a good one, it has a list of all the kings of Israel. And then it has a description of their character qualities by their names. And it says bad, 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 bad. But then you get to two, and it says worse, and even worse yet. And that's the ones we're going to look at here. 1 Kings chapter 16, beginning in verse 23. 1 Kings 16, 23. In the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king over Israel, and reigned 12 years. 6 years he reigned in Tirzah. And he bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents, and then he built on the hill. Let's go down to verse number 25. Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and did worse than all who were before him. So all the other kings of Israel were bad, 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 but he was even worse. Verse 26. For he walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and in his sin by which he had made Israel sin, provoking the Lord of God to anger with their idols. And a marginal reference here is the Asherah, those groves where they set up their high places and again had the tree worship, etc., with their idols and all that they did. It gets even worse yet. Let's go down to verse number 30. Now Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. So we go from Omri, who's worse, to another that's even worse, Ahab. Verse 31. And it came to pass, as though it had not been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, that he took as his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him. Worshipping Baal, a foreign god, again, in conjunction with Asherah and all the other pagan worship. The Nelson Study Bible says, the spiritual history of the northern kingdom reached its lowest point under the rules of Omri and Ahab. And Haley's adds this, all the kings of Israel served the calf, but the worst served Baal. The very worst, and we're reading about that. So they kept going worse and worse downhill. Verse 32, then he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made a wooden image Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. And it doesn't even go into all the details, but we can imagine. If it was so bad, God says this was the worst, the absolute worst it had been. Ahab and his wife Jezebel, in a marriage that was arranged by Omri, brought about the state worship of Baal and Asherah. In other words, no one was allowed to worship God anymore, only paganism. Again, we saw that that happened with the Roman emperors later on, where they set up the state worship, begin to put down Judaism. Remember, we talked about that the last time. Anything Jewish was put down to the ground, but beginning to accept paganism in the practices. Wasn't done just by the Roman emperors. It was done by kings of Israel many years before. For these reasons, and despite the presence of the temple, God was going to bring judgment upon the children of Israel, judgment and captivity. So these blending practices, the mixing of paganism with the worship of God, has been repeated down throughout the history of mankind, and even amongst the children of Israel. We saw it happened to the New Testament church. We talked about in Acts chapter 19, where in 20, where the Apostle Paul warned the elders in Ephesus that there's false teachers coming amongst you that begin to say that it's okay to do these things, these pagan practices, saying that they were inspired by God. Again, a repeat of what had happened throughout history. And it would deceive many in the New Testament church. And it also applies to the modern nations of Israel in our day and time by worshiping a modified form of ancient Baal worship. Jesus Christ warned about the deception that would take place, and specifically warned the disciples to watch out for deceit in his warnings to them when they asked, what would be the signs of your imminent return in the end of the age? The first thing that he brought to their attention, watch out for deceit. And that would be taking place just a short time after his death and when the apostles began to do their work in preaching the gospel message. Let's take a look at a few more scriptures as we begin to wind down here now. Again, the message a little on the shorter side because of the Bible study to follow. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. These things that this blending of paganism while saying that you're worshiping God has something that had been repeated over and over in the history of the world. And again, with Israel as well. The Apostle Paul warned the Corinthians. We looked at the warning he gave to the elders in Ephesus the last time. In Acts, but let's take a look in 2 Corinthians. Second Corinthians chapter 11. And let's pick it up in verse number 4. Second Corinthians. Well, actually, let's pick it up in verse number 3. But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, and that deception, you know, goes all the way back to the deception of Adam and Eve and then continued out throughout history. The serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. Verse number 4, here's the warning. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit, which you have not received, or a different gospel, which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. He's warning them that these false teachers are coming amongst you, and they're going to be saying, it's okay to do these things, as long as you're doing it in the name and worshiping God. Verse number 13. For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, verse 14, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. So over and over again, we find these warnings in the New Testament scriptures, warning about deceit that was going to be coming upon the New Testament church. And as we talked about the last time, they finally had to go underground because of the persecution that was coming upon them. And then after the first century AD, another church rises up on the scene and begins to preach a different gospel than the one that Christ and the apostles had taught. Let's go to the book of Jude, right before Revelation. Jude warned of these false apostles as well. Just a couple more scriptures here as we begin to close. Jude chapter 4. Jude verse number 4. There is no chapter 4. Jude 4. For certain men have crept in unnoticed. And you know that happened in the history of our church too, 20 years ago. Certain men have crept in unnoticed, who long ago were marked out for this condemnation. Same thing that we've been talking about in this sermon today. This repeat of the blending, mixing paganism in and saying you're worshiping God. It's okay to do it. Certain men have crept in unnoticed, who long ago were marked out for this condemnation. Ungodly men who turn the grace of our God into lewdness. Lewdness. Absolute corruption, false practice, and deny the Lord, the only Lord God, in our Lord Jesus Christ. Pagan customs were being introduced into the church, and Jude was writing about that to the church. William Barclay adds this. He says, these people, these false teachers, were immoral in life and heretical in belief. And that practice, going all the way back to ancient history, repeating down throughout the history of Israel, the New Testament church, even our day and time, has been this blending practice of paganism, mixing it with Christianity, has been the repeating process throughout history. Let's finally go to Mark chapter 13. It's been the great deception. Mark chapter 13. The companion of Matthew chapter 24, where Christ was telling the disciples, where he was answering their question of the end time and the imminent his imminent return and the things that they should be watching out for. Mark 13, verse number 5. Jesus answered them and began to say, take heed that no one deceives you. That's what he told the disciples who became the apostles, who are going to be going out in preaching in the first century A.D. Take heed that no one deceives you. And then notice verse 22. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show signs and wonders to deceive, notice, if possible, even the elect. Even the elect, people who are part of the church, can be deceived as well. Falling away from the truth, from worshiping God the way that he commands, has been repeating itself throughout history. The blending of paganism with Christianity is the pattern of apostasy. It happened, brethren, 20 years ago in the church as well. And it can happen again. Let us not be deceived.